Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Good morning and welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning we have three different interviews for you. First off, we start with Mark Latkovic. He's written the book, What's a Person to Do? This talks about everyday decision making. And then we speak with Lorraine Bennett, and she's written a great book for caregivers called A Year of Grace, Reflections for Caregivers. And then finally, we have an interview with Mark Brumley, and he speaks about the book To Know Jesus as the Christ, and this is written by Cardinal Schonberg. So we'll bring you those interviews right now. Good morning and welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning we're speaking with Mark Latkovic. He's the author of the book, What's a Person to Do? Everyday Decisions That Matter. This is published by Our Sunday Visitor. Welcome, Mark.
It's good to be here.
Tell us about this book. Is this on decision-making, obviously, correct?
Right. It's basically a little ethics book dealing with 40 questions that many people encounter in their daily lives. They're not questions that are dealing with, I guess you could say, the big issues like abortion and euthanasia, but they're dealing with just everyday decisions, and thus the title of the book, What's a Person to Do? Everyday Decisions That Matter. Questions such as, what about a Facebook account? Are there any ethical issues with having a Facebook account? What about cell phones? What are some of the ethical issues surrounding the use of cell phones? When should our children have a cell phone? Those kinds of questions. And I deal also with a lot of questions pertaining to work problems, ethical problems that a person might encounter in work, at work. So it's just meant to be a book that is very accessible to the average Catholic. You don't have to have a PhD in ethics to read it. It's, I think, very accessible. It's written in non-technical language, and it's really not just for Catholics. I think any person of faith or even of no faith could pick the book up and benefit from some of the questions and my responses to them.
Mark, tell us a little bit about why you decided to write this book and about your background.
Well, you know, OSV, Our Sunday Visitor, the publisher of the book, they had approached me a few years ago about writing such a book. They thought that there was sort of a gap. Again, I mentioned how we have the big issues like beginning of life, end of life, and this book was meant to sort of fill that gap, to help people to make decisions in their everyday lives about these kinds of issues, issues that aren't often treated in moral theology books, books dealing with ethics, but that nonetheless have an ethical dimension. They have certain ethical aspects to them. And so they asked me to write the book, and I came up with 40 questions. They had suggested, the editors there, a few of the questions, and then I kind of reworked them. I tried to keep them very simple and straightforward, knowing that each of the questions that I treat, you could really expand them, you could approach them from different angles. There's so many nuances that you could have. But they had contacted me, I think, because they knew I had been teaching moral theology for almost 25 years at Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit, and so my background was in ethics and moral theology, and I had been doing a lot of writing, not only on the scholarly level, but also the popular level, and so they wanted to make sure that I could put together such a book, one that wouldn't be so much directed to the scholar as to the everyday Catholic who's looking to grow in holiness, looking to develop virtue, and so on.
That's great to know your background as a theologian at a seminary. Are these some of the things that priests are struggling with, too, in terms of their pastoral ministries?
Yes, you know, that's a great question. They are, and they're questions that fall through the cracks. They don't often get treated in our moral theology classes, and so there are questions, though, that people are asking, and the seminarians, priests, are encountering these kinds of questions, and it can be difficult to find answers that really treat them in a very straightforward way, a non-technical way. Sometimes they're just questions that aren't even asked at all. I think sometimes people don't realize that there are these questions about certain aspects of their lives that maybe they just don't see as an ethical question. Usually, I think all of us are accustomed, especially we as Christians, we're accustomed to thinking in terms of the Ten Commandments. And so anything that doesn't sort of fall strictly under one of those commandments in the Decalogue, we don't see it as an ethical issue. And so a question like, is it morally okay for me to be on Facebook? You know, we think, what? You know, everyone's on Facebook. Why would that be an ethical question? And usually I'll say something like, well, even if it is okay, I think it is, I'm on Facebook myself, that doesn't mean that there aren't certain moral principles, certain virtues that one has to have in order to use Facebook or any technology, social media, well, morally well. And so that's really what I'm trying to do in the book, what I'm trying to do even more in my own teaching at the seminary, is to try to show that our moral issues go beyond just some of the ones we associate with the Ten Commandments.
Yes, I'd like to think of technology these days, the way I think about food. I mean, certainly you can stay away from it completely, but there is good in it, and there is ways that you should be using it for your own benefit, and that God has provided it for you for your own, you know, goodness and enjoyment. But we are fallen creatures, and sometimes with things like technology and food, we don't know when to say no. We don't know when to deny ourselves time on these social media sites, or we overindulge. So talk about the fallen nature of man and how, although these are a inherent good, they can quickly degenerate into something that would not be good for our spiritual health if we are overindulging.
Another good question. I think the fallenness that you're speaking of really, I think, is an aspect that we don't often want to face, because having to face that, I think, does raise a lot of questions about our use of not only technology but other areas. You mentioned food, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why I try to take a virtue approach in the book, because I say we need the moral virtues. We need virtues such as prudence or moral wisdom. We need fortitude or courage. We need temperance or moderation. We need justice. We need charity. We need all of these virtues to help restore us, to help overcome that fallen nature that we have. Ultimately, we as Christians believe that the three theological virtues of faith, hope, and love, those virtues that directly relate us to God, are going to, in tandem with the moral virtues that are something that we develop on our own, obviously with God's grace too, but those two sets of virtues working together will help us to deal with the challenges not only of our own fallen nature, but the kinds of issues that our culture is imposing on us, the kinds of temptations that are coming from outside, not only from within, but from outside in the secular culture. A culture, I think, that all of us as Catholics are not immune to, being influenced by. So, thus, the virtue approach, I think, is very helpful, because with a lot of the questions, there might not be a cut-and-dried answer. It might not be black and white. You can look at it from different sides. And so the virtues, I think, are good way to approach the questions, because there's a recognition there that what might be appropriate for you, maybe spending 3 hours on Facebook wouldn't be appropriate for me, given my personal vocation, my state in life. And so the virtues are going to help one to sort out a lot of those issues of, how do I approach this issue? What is the right or wrong answer for me in terms of this particular issue?
We're speaking with Mark Latkovic, and he's the author of What's a Person to Do? Everyday Decisions That Matter. This is published by Our Sunday Visitor. Mark, can you address the area for parents? And you talk about virtue training and education. And I think many of us would be appalled if we sat down with a child with, like, you know, carte blanche at McDonald's and said, you know, do whatever you want and run through the store and spend as much time as you want here and eat as whatever you want. But with technology, oftentimes parents feel that, you know, if a child is being entertained, whether it be Game Boy or whatever, you know, phone or whatever games he's got on their social media devices, and they're spending hours and hours in their room and being quiet, that's nothing, not a big deal. And parents are sometimes reluctant to intervene in those situations where they would be in other areas. Why is it that technology, parents back off so much and allow so much for their kids to decide? Is it that they don't know it or they're not aware? Or speak to this issue.
I think some of it is that they're not aware, they're not familiar. It might be a generational thing in some cases where the parents are just unfamiliar with the technology, or the culture is so accepting of various technologies, social media and the like, and so they don't see it as a real big deal. There's a certain, I don't want to say peer pressure, but, you know, parental pressure, other parents, you know, that maybe they associate with, will say, oh, you know, it's really not a big deal. You know, my own kid has this, has that particular technology, and, you know, they don't see any problems with it. But I do think it's something that parents need to monitor. They need to be aware of what's going on, because unlike some technologies of old, even a landline phone, with a cell phone, for example, you know, children can be doing things on that unbeknownst to the parent, unlike a lot of earlier technology where it was very obvious. You know, if you wanted to talk to your girlfriend, it was very difficult, you know, to do it in secret, right? You know, you had to be on the landline, and then your parent might pick up the phone at the other end and say, "Hey, who are you talking to?" You know, "Oh, no one, Dad." It was much more difficult, I think, to hide things. Now it's much easier. So again, parents have to be aware. They have to be monitoring it. They have to familiarize themselves with the technology. If their 13, 14-year-old is on Facebook, they need to be on Facebook too, the parent, and be friends with their child on Facebook, so that they can monitor what their child is doing, what the friends of their child is doing. They need to be involved, because there's just so much that can go wrong. There's so much good that can be accomplished, but there's so much that can go wrong, too.
Yeah, we were at a recent conference here in Doylestown, and the speaker was Mark Hart, who many are familiar with as the Life Teen youth minister, and I guess he's the vice president of Life Teen. Talks about his own children and how, you know, although we are in a wireless culture, we are more enslaved than ever. And, you know, speaking to his child and saying, you know, "I'm going to set you free. I'm going to unplug you from your iPhone or whatever you have here." Let's talk a little bit from a moral theologian standpoint about these ideas of being sort of secluded in and of ourselves, these virtual relationships where we're not really dealing with the community around us, family or friends, but creating our own realities and creating our own ways of spending time that are completely self-sufficient and not requiring any of our kids or even ourselves to go out and have difficult conversations or interact in ways that might be boring. Talk a little bit about how detrimental that is to the overall shape and character, not only of children, but of ourselves.
Great question. I think I've heard the phrase absent presence, where you might be present, physically present, to your family, whether it's at the dinner table or whether it's in the living room or when you're out at a restaurant, but you're not really mentally, spiritually, emotionally present. There's an absence there. There's a withdrawal because of technology, where, as you're saying, you know, you're really sucked into your own little virtual world, and you're not really doing the kinds of things that we would say a truly human life is all about. Reacting, dealing with, talking with, communicating with, in a physical way, reaching out to other people, reaching out to try to achieve human goods in the real world, not in the virtual world. And so I think there's a detrimental impact on the family, on our social relationships with friends, even with our, you know, our own self, you know, the relationship we have with ourselves. I think it is damaged. There's kind of an existential crisis that's created where we're not really dealing with the real world. We're dealing with this fiction. Now, having said that, it's clear that a lot of it, you know, all of this can enable us to reach out to people. It can enable us to communicate in ways in which we could not do before this technology. And there's some definite blessings. There's some definite benefits to that, the way we can share thoughts, the way we can share videos and images and things like that. But again, this has to be seen as kind of a supplement to the real life, the real world that we're living in. I'm not saying that being on Facebook is not the real world. I use it myself. Just before this interview, I was on Facebook, you know, posting things. I use it for evangelization purposes. I use it to keep in touch with friends that cannot be physically present. That's all good. That's wonderful. I think we should look at that as a blessing from God. But we have to remember that, you know, at the end of the day, our most precious relationships have to have that presence. They have to have that that physical, this world, this reality component to them. That's... And they have to be, I think, governed by sound moral principles. They have to be governed by those moral virtues. Otherwise, our fallen human nature, the secular culture, all of those things can really impede us from being the kinds of persons that God wants us to be, you know, holy, saints, other Christs, people.
And I think a good ground rule for that is always the middle ground, you know, not extreme in one direction or the other. Is that a good way to look at that?
Yeah, you know, and I think that's really what the virtues are about, you know, achieving that that balance, achieving that, you know, that middle course where you're avoiding the extremes of too much or too little. We can eat too much, but sometimes we can eat too little. We have to eat what will be healthy for us, right? We have to achieve that balance. And that goes for any area of our life. We can think about all the problems that human beings deal with, right? We deal with sexuality. We deal with eating and drinking. We deal with anger issues, all these kinds of problems that can trip us up and get in our way, impede our way to the kingdom. And so we need a virtue that corresponds to one of those problems to help us to deal with it, to transform ourselves, transform our actions, our work, and to really help us to deal with these obstacles, whether it be eating too little or eating too much. That's what the virtues are about, achieving that middle course.
Yes, and it
avoiding the excesses.
Right, and it is tempting for a parent in some situations to avoid the world and sort of live in a community that's self-enclosed, and that certainly isn't something that's necessarily healthy either. You have to be in the world, but not of the world.
That's right. And even in that area, I think each family, according to their own personal vocation, you know, they're going to make decisions that they think is, you know, is best for their family. But there's always that balance. There's always that, you know, that back and forth where you say, okay, on this issue, we're going to withdraw a little bit so that we can eventually go back in to the world. On this issue, no, we're okay. That issue, we're going to withdraw a little, you know, here and there. It's kind of a back and forth. You'll see parents who homeschool their children and there's so many great benefits to that. Others think, no, you know, we're not going to homeschool. We just don't feel called to that, et cetera. On other issues, parents will say, no, we're not going to withdraw from the world in this particular area. We're going to be right out there, you know. You pick your issue, you pick your battles, what you see is best for your family. But ultimately, it's to ground yourself. It's to equip yourself, right, so that you can go into the world and evangelize. I mean, all of us are called, right, to do that, individuals, families, to be God's ambassadors, right, to be missionary.
Great advice. Yes, exactly. And the name of the book, again, is called What's a Person to Do? Everyday Decisions That Matter, put out by Our Sunday Visitor. And Mark, where can they find a copy of this to look at those 40 questions and the various ways of dealing with them?
They can order the book directly from Our Sunday Visitor Press. They can just go online, or they can go on Amazon and order the book. I also have an Amazon author page. When they order the book, they can see my page there. I have a blog on there and my Twitter feeds. They can also, if they're on Facebook, they can go on Facebook, and if they have the book, or even if they don't have the book, they can engage me as the author by asking questions about the book or asking everyday moral questions that they might have that aren't in the book. We've already got a list of those, maybe a second edition. So there's lots of ways that they can kind of engage me as an author of the book and engage the book itself on Facebook.
That sounds like a great book, and it's certainly good for anyone, be a young person or young adults or newly married, you know, middle aged to grandparents.
Yeah.
Everyone can benefit from this.
Yeah, you know, it's really designed for, teachers in Catholic high schools. It's for parents, you know, as you said, grandparents, catechists. Really, it's I think, a wide audience of persons that could benefit from it. Men's groups, women's groups could tackle it. So a lot of different audiences, I think.
Well, we thank you very much, Mark, for writing it. Again,
Mark
Latkovic, and his book again, What's a Person to Do? Everyday Decisions That Matter. Thank you so much, Mark, for being with us today.
Thanks, Barbara. I really appreciate it. Thanks. God bless.
You are listening to Walking in Faith, right here at Holy Spirit Radio, 1570 AM in Doylestown and 1420 AM in Coatesville and Chester County. Good morning and welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning we're speaking with Lorraine Bennett. She's written the book A Year of Grace, 365 Reflections for Caregivers. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Barbara.
Well, thank you for addressing what a critical issue this is, people who are taking care of loved ones. And there's so many different emotions and periods of, exuberance and then complete loneliness or maybe overwhelmed with emotions in terms of being tired. Talk a little bit about what inspired you to write this book.
Yes, well, it all started with my mom, who she had been a very talented, independent, articulate. She was artistic. She was just a fantastic person and a great Catholic as well. And she suddenly suffered this massive incapacitating stroke. So it completely changed her life. Like, she was totally devastated because she could no longer talk. She could no longer walk. She couldn't eat. She couldn't even read, which was one of the things she just loved doing. And she couldn't do anything. And so she's in this rehab out in Nevada, and I was all the way across the country in Virginia, and so I started praying to St. Joseph to help me, we were doing novenas one after the other, trying to get her from there to here, but we had to find a medical flight. Anyway, so we finally long story short, on St. Joseph's feast day, we were able to fly her out from Nevada to here to Virginia, and then she went into a 24-hour care nursing facility, basically, because she really couldn't do anything for herself anymore. And so from that point onward, I would visit her every day. And so during this process, I was looking for something to read that would be inspiring and helpful, and I would read the Magnificat, but there wasn't anything specifically for caregivers. So that's when I got the idea that maybe I should write this, both for myself and for other people who were in similar situations, whether they cared for an elderly parent at home or whether they had a handicapped child and they couldn't get out much. And that's mainly the idea that I had behind writing this book.
Talk a little bit about your mother. How old was she when she had the stroke?
Well, she was almost 90 when she had the stroke, or 90, so she was up there. But she was, it's just that she was such a vibrant, independent person, so that's why it was such a dramatic shock to go from this person who was independently living to somebody who couldn't do anything that she formerly could do. And so, you know, just kind of puts you on your knees.
Absolutely.
At that point, and you say, "Hi, you know, why is this happening?" And you know, you really wonder, you know, what has God in mind here? And that was kind of I was pondering that, and throughout the book, I reflected on that as well, because I think, you know, both caregivers and cared for, sometimes they wonder, you know, why are we in this situation, and what, you know, is there, you know, what is the hope that we need to hold on to at this point, and what kind of joy can we find in the situation as well? And so I was hoping to speak to that in these reflections, and not to sugarcoat it, you know, because the reality of the caregiver's situation is just can be really rough, and they can be all alone and exhausted, and hardly getting any respect from anybody around them either, you know, and they can just feel really overwhelmed and devastated by the whole process. So I was hoping to bring a little encouragement into their lives as well, if I could, by these reflections, which are short because caregivers don't have much time.
Right. Did you want to read one of them?
Yeah, I'd love to. Let's see. I guess I'll read I just opened it to a random page. I'll read from July 12th. It's called Blessing the Song of the World. And the quote is, "You are called with all the saints to bless in the power of Christ's priesthood the song of the world and to perfect it." That's from Gerald Van. A blind opera singer comes to perform for the elderly at the nursing home. His voice is powerful yet gentle, too, bringing tears to our eyes. At the end, I wheel my mom up to him to thank him. He can't see her, and she can't speak, but she holds her hand out to him, and I guide his hand to hers. Two souls, each suffering in their own way, each with a blessing to give.
That's beautiful. And, you know, that speaks to, you talk about the caregiving and a decision that some people make with regards to how frequently they should be in the presence of someone, and it may be especially hard if the person can't respond back or you
right.
don't have any kind of real communication as to their needs and your needs. How do you balance mm-hmm. that?
Yeah, well, I think that's where prayer comes in, and, you know, they say the busier you are, the more you need to pray, and I really felt that very strongly, and I would always start the day with some sort of reflection, and I think that really helped order my day as well. And I think that for caregivers too, you know, they don't have much time. Like they probably a lot of times they can't get out and go to Mass or go to a holy hour or something that are, you know, wonderful things that we can do when we do have time. But sometimes they're stuck in a situation where they just really don't have any time. And so that's why I think the short reflections are really helpful. And one of the things I discovered is when caring for somebody who couldn't speak is that so many other things became more important. Like, I started, like, at first it seemed, you know, it seems awkward, and I would read to her, and, you know, and I would, we would try, oh, she was also getting speech therapy at the time, and, you know, they really were trying and working with her, the speech therapist was, but it just really wasn't happening. And as we sort of settled into our routine, I discovered, like, so many blessings in just being quiet and just being with the person. And even if you can't do any of the things you used to do, you know, just do what you can. And we would often look at, I would show my mom pictures from her old albums. So she would definitely recognize them because she could point with, you know, one, she had one working arm, and she could point her finger, and she could point to the pictures, and I would name the names, and, you know, I would sort of do the talking. but again, I really think there's so much to be learned from just from being with the person. Even if you can't do anything, you start to appreciate just their very being. Their, you know, their very existence becomes just a delight. And, you know, her smile, we look out the window and we see a bird, you know, and these things became so much more important than our usual rushing about and getting things done and all that sort of thing that we're so used to in our society.
Yes. Then you had a routine now. How long did you spend each day with your mother in care?
Okay. Well, I tried to spend as many hours as I could be there. But again, I was in, it was like, you know, the sandwich generation. I was trying to, you know, balance my own work with my family and then visiting her every day. So, you know, I would do as many hours as I could, you know, and take her out for the brief amount of time that I would be allowed to go outside with her, because most of the time she was in bed, and she could have, we kind of figured it out, like 45 minutes was her max, and she could get in a wheelchair. And so for that 45 minutes, we would stroll around and look at all the trees and look at the flowers and say hello to people, you know, as we were passing them, and then get her back into her bed. And then, you know, that was kind of her day, was pretty much always in bed except for that 45 minutes. And, you know, so it was quite an adventure in a very different way. And, you know, I learned a lot from this experience. There are just so many lessons that really about the value and the dignity of human life, and how God can show us that there is joy in suffering if we can, you know, if we can really pay attention to what he's trying to, the grace that he's trying to give us in the moment. So, you know, initially I was just like completely upset about the whole thing for my mom's sake and thinking, oh, she can't do anything she used to love. But then we discovered that there were things that she could enjoy in life, even in the state that she was in. And that's kind of what, you know, what really struck me. God will help you find the joy in the small things. If, you know, if that's all there are, the small things, you know, God will help us find those things.
Yes. And, well, yeah. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I finish with your thought, please.
Oh, I was going to say, that's what I tried to share, some of those things in the book. So, and also, some of the really awesome people that were there in the nursing home that I met in the process of this whole thing. So maybe I could read one of them to sort of illustrate what I'm saying about the idea of always having hope, no matter what situation you're in, and also the dignity of the human person, no matter what. You know, in our society, we value our productivity, you know, what you can do, you know, how effective are you? How many things can you accomplish and check off on your to-do list, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to people in the nursing home or people who are home with caring for an elderly loved one, you know, these aren't productive in the eyes of the world. But in God's eyes, these people are even more important. And so that was kind of the thing that I was hoping to convey.
Yes, and you have, as you say, wonderful little quotes for each day. This is a 365-day kind of mini retreat reflection kind of book. And on October 30th, you have a quote from David Snowden, Aging with Grace. And he says, "Dr. Snowden, do you know what my worst fear was?" And now her eyes started to well up with tears. "That I was going to forget Jesus," she said. "I finally realized that I may not remember him, but he will remember me." It's a very poignant quote from someone who has a close relationship with God and is fearful that as they age, you know, with your cognitive abilities diminishing possibly, that you would have this fear. And I think that's a great consolation that she got, you know, that Jesus would never forget her no matter what happens to her. And then you write about a 68-year-old retired physician began blogging about his own diagnosis with Alzheimer's. And he wants to counter the fear and embarrassment surrounding the disease by discussing his symptoms and his life's journey. And he writes that he is far happier than he used to be. He's more vulnerable and open to others, and yet he fears the loneliness and isolation that the advanced stages of the disease may bring. And, you know, this is really the question in our society and our culture today is that, you know, you often hear horror tales about people in nursing homes with regards to being over-medicated and, you know, given drugs so that they basically are just going to be dozing the whole day and gotten rid of.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fear with regards to, you know, the effects with political movements such as euthanasia, that these lives really are basically over. You know, your mother was 90. She lived a long life. Isn't it time for hospice and, you know, a quick exit? So talk a little bit about that.
Gosh, well, you know, I actually, that was a fear in the back of my mind. But we were just really blessed with some great doctors and nurses. And just from the very beginning, when she first had her stroke and she was in the hospital in Nevada, we had a fantastic doctor there because, I mean, she could not eat. And so they had to put a feeding tube in her. You know, and I was, at that moment, I was thinking, oh my gosh, what if they, you know, what if they don't want to do this? And they say, well, just, you know, she can't eat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And because I'd heard, like you said, I'd heard these horror stories. However, we didn't experience any of those. So people were super helpful. And the doctors and the nurses were all so caring. And they, you know, they wanted to make her as comfortable as she could be. So they did have to balance out. You know, it was a daily task figuring out, you know, how much food to give her to keep her going, but in how much, and what about pain, how to relieve her of pain, because she did have pain. And, you know, you don't want somebody just in pain every day. And so every day they would monitor, and we had, you know, care conferences. I think it was once a month we did that, and, you know, I would get together with the nutritionists and the, you know, the nurses and the doctors, and you know, we would make sure that she was not over-medicated and that she was receiving just the right kind of care that she needed. And so I'm really grateful for them and, you know, thankful that there's still some good people out there.
Yes. And, you know, you write about how important it was to get to know your mother in this very different stage of her life and how God really brings good through suffering. And what you said, you learned a lot through this whole period of transition. So was it, in your sense, a greater appreciation of who your mother was as a person that you wouldn't have gotten had you not been with her in this final stage of her life? Or talk a little bit about what you learned with regards to that.
Yeah, well, really her personality was different because of the stroke. And yet at times I would still get a glimpse of her old personality. So it was kind of an odd thing that we just had to kind of adjust to it. And every once in a while I would get glimpses of, you know, like as I was mentioning with looking at the photographs, or sometimes we would be able to watch a TV show that was something that she had, you know, like an old movie, you know, and it would come on and I would say, oh my goodness, here's one that there's Jimmy Stewart. My mom loves Jimmy Stewart, you know. And then so we would try to, you know, kind of relate on some of those levels that, you know, that was reflected her previous personality. But her new personality was really very different and really sweet, actually. Like, just her openness to everyone. She seemed to, I actually have a reflection on this, but I don't think I can find it right at the moment. But she seemed to love everybody equally, and as though they were her old friends. And like when we would be going strolling outside, and she would see the gardener, she would wave to him. She would start waving like she knew this man, you know, and she didn't. But you know, then there would be the janitor. She'd see him, she'd wave, big smile, and he'd always say, "God bless you." And he was wonderful. And then we'd, you know, come back inside, and the nurses, and she was so glad to see them, because she didn't like being in the wheelchair because it gave her pain. You know, she was so grateful when they would put her back in bed. And that was a new aspect of her personality. It was wonderful.
And what recommendations would you give to caregivers? It sounds like you were working, I don't know, full-time or part-time, but how frequently, and the benefits, and, you know, weighing that against your obligations to your family. What advice do you have for people that are potential caregivers?
Yeah, well, ideally, I guess it would be wonderful to have one's elderly parents, you know, living with one, you know, as opposed to having to be in a nursing facility. You know, but sometimes it's just, that's the only thing you can do. Like, we were in the process, for example, of, you know, we would have had to get a wheelchair ramp and get a van that can have a wheelchair in it, and to even get my mom into our house. So, you know, we were actually looking into that, but we ended up finding this really wonderful place where she was able to stay, and I really think she probably had better care there than I could have actually done in my own home. So I know it sounds, maybe it sounds bad to say it's not always the best to have the person in your home. Maybe it is, I mean, but not everybody's situation is the same. So if you can, I think that's wonderful, but sometimes you can't, and I think that these decisions you just have to make in prayer, and if you have a trusted priest that you can ask for advice, and that would be the thing to do. These are really difficult situations to be in. I was just talking to a lady at a conference, and she was caring for her mother-in-law, who has Alzheimer's, and in her own home, but the mother-in-law sometimes just wanders off, you know, just leaves, and that's a real danger with somebody with Alzheimer's. And so, you know, that's a scary kind of situation to be in. So whether you need caregivers, home caregivers, you know, coming into the home, or whether you need to go seek outside help, you know, every situation is different.
And how do you balance your own family needs versus those of your extended family that you're caring for?
Yeah, well, I think that's the prayer part. I think that's the key. And I can't, like, emphasize enough that I had to go to, for me, I would go to daily mass, and that was kind of the reordering of everything in the day. If I didn't pray daily, if I didn't go to daily mass, then things would get out of control, it seemed to me. And I would start stressing about, you know, I'm not doing this at home, or I'm not doing this for my mom, or I'm not, you know, you start to, the anxiety level increases, and you really just have to put that back, you know, give it back to God, and say, God, help me, you know, you know, God is the God of order, and he knows what is the perfect order for our lives, and so we just have to beg him and ask him to help. Tell you how, you know, when, if something is getting slightly out of control, or you're starting to feel overwhelmed and stressed out, place your trust in him and ask him to help you organize. And for me, it really worked out extremely well, as long as I had all those pieces together. Like, I had to visit my mom, I had to go to mass, you know, I had to work on my book. I was writing the book at the time. So, you know, just as long as I kept those things in balance, then I was balanced. I wasn't, yes, like, turning into a hysterical, stressed out woman.
You know, and we would be very remiss, Lorraine, if we didn't point out that you are also, and I'm looking at this now and I'm realizing, you're the author of some of the most standard books that parents use with regards to their own marriages and their own children. It's The Temperament God Gave You, The Temperament God Gave Your Spouse, and The Temperament God Gave Your Kids, as well as one on emotions, The Emotions God Gave You. So many of our listeners will be familiar with you as the author of those publications as well.
That's right. Thank you. Thanks for mentioning those.
Yeah, and how important is that with regards to relationships in a family?
Yeah, well, yeah, thank you for mentioning that. You know, my husband, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and we decided to kind of resurrect this a classic concept from Catholic spirituality, which is the concept of the temperaments. And it's also something that is discussed, of course, in contemporary psychology. But the interesting part about that is that it has this long tradition within Catholic spirituality. And so we thought, well, you know, this is something that's really great, that's very helpful, practical for parents and spouses to understand each other's temperament and to understand the temperament of your kids. So that's what kind of launched us into writing these really practical books about temperament.
And Lorraine, where can people find you if they'd like to find out more about those books or about this book, which is called A Year of Grace, 365 Reflections for Caregivers?
I think the best thing is probably just you could check on Amazon, and all our books are there on Amazon. I created a website, but unfortunately, it's not, I don't think it's that functional, so I can't even give you the address of it.
Okay,
I just created it,
all right.
And I think I'm going to have to start a blog or something, but...
Yes. Well, I know the technology, you know, sometimes it's there and sometimes it isn't day to day with regards to these things. But
yeah,
we are speaking with Lorraine Bennett, L-A-R-A-I-N-E, Bennett, B-E-N-N-E-T-T. Again, she's written the book, A Year of Grace, 365 Reflections for Caregivers, and with her husband has authored The Temperament God Gave You, The Temperament God Gave Your Spouse, and The Temperament God Gave Your Kids, which are great ways to figure out why we respond differently to certain situations, and knowing that and having that knowledge ahead of time helps us to get along with each other better. And so those are great books to also tap into as well. Thank you so much, Lorraine, for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara, for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
Are you working on anything new?
Not right now.
Taking a breather, right?
Yeah, I am taking a little breather, yeah.
That's well deserved. Thank you so much for being with us, Lorraine.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning we're speaking with Mark Brumley. He's here to talk about the book To Know Jesus as the Christ, written by Cardinal Schoenberg. Welcome.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
You know, Mark, I have to say, I really love this book because it really talks about a shepherd's heart. And Cardinal Schoenberg, you know, certainly led this book as a series of catechesis. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, sure. Of course, catechesis is just a systematic presentation of the truths of the faith. And Cardinal Schoenborn, you probably know this, your listeners may know this, that he is the primary editor for the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And so he's very much concerned with communicating the faith and doing it in a way that's clear, you know, that's life-giving and vital, but also kind of systematic so people come to know all about Jesus.
And Mark, what is it about the language of Cardinal Schoenberg that makes this book so accessible? It's not really dry theological pondering, is it? It's written conversationally.
No, I think he's trying to, first of all, it's based on, you know, his addresses to an audience and trying to connect with that audience, you know, of contemporary people who aren't necessarily theologians. And so he kind of carries over that style. He looks to people like C.S. Lewis, who were, you know, Lewis is a masterful communicator of the gospel message. So I think that's why the book is so accessible. But it's interesting. It's, you know, it's kind of one of these middle-of-the-road things in a sense that it's not, you know, just really, really, really basic, but on the other hand, it's not highfalutin theology. So it's kind of in between where I think probably the vast majority of Catholics in the pew are. So he's trying to reach those folks. I think that accounts for his style.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, some of the scriptures he uses to define his points are just stunning because it's something that, you know, you've read scripture over and over and over again, but you've never really put it in that kind of perspective. Do you agree?
Yeah, that's one of the things he does is he uses scripture to go through some of the key elements of the creed, which we say at Mass every Sunday, help us understand the creed better. He starts with scripture, but he also goes into church history and looks at different controversies and things that arose over the centuries.
Right, and he talks about his relation, Christ's relationship with the Father, and the way we know the Trinity is through Jesus Christ. And then he gives scriptural examples of that, for example, in the first part of the book. He actually has about 8 different catechesis that he offers in this book. Do you want to run through some of them just as a sort of an overview?
Sure. You know, the basic structure of his instruction follows the creed. So he starts out with God as Trinity, and God is one, God is triune, and talks about the role of Jesus as a revealer of the Trinity, and really kind of what's the point of the Trinity, which is that, you know, for us, we know more about who God is, and we can participate and come to share in God's own life. And he talks about God being all-powerful, as we say in the creed. God is, you know, all-powerful, almighty, the almighty God. And the seeming, you know, how do you reconcile that with evil in the world? It, you know, and how do we combine the notion of God's providence, which means God's in charge of the world, with freedom and sin that we see. Now, of course, this is a great mystery, so it's not that Cardinal Schoenborn is going to explain every single conceivable issue that can arise in connection with that, but he does kind of give some general principles that we should all keep in mind trying to understand the world and what's going on in the world. And then he goes on and talk about the uniqueness of Jesus, that salvation comes only through Jesus, the uniqueness of the church. What's the significance of the church? Is there one church? Are there many churches? The miracles of Jesus as signs, and I think that's a really kind of an interesting thing, because we often think of miracles as kind of, sometimes we think of miracles as ways of short-circuiting faith. If I could only see a miracle, I'd believe. But he goes, Cardinal Schoenborn explains that miracles are signs, and they're there to strengthen faith, but they don't supplant it. They don't do away with the need for it. The resurrection of Jesus, of course, being in the Easter season, that's very important for us. Of course, it's important all year round, but he talks about what's the significance of Jesus' resurrection. Then Our Lady, what's her role in salvation? And then finally, the life of the world to come, what happens after death?
Mark, would you recommend this book as someone who hasn't read through the Catechism, you know, as a good precursor, as a good sort of overview for that?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. That really summarizes it well. It's a nice little sort of introduction or entree into the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
What surprised you most about this book when you read it? What was new to you when you
I was kind of surprised by some of the questions that he deals with. You know, he very much is, Cardinal Shomar is very much aware of what's going on, and not just like biblical studies at a sort of high end intellectually, but what's going on in the popular culture. And so he kind of raises some questions about who Jesus is. And I was a little surprised that he was going to go into those kinds of things in that much detail. You know, the other thing, you mentioned how this book uses the Bible a lot. I was somewhat impressed by his biblical apologetics. Now, who might be impressed or not impressed with Cardinal Schönborn?
That's right.
But it was notable how much he went back to the Bible time and again to sort of make his point. And in that respect, you know, it's kind of a useful ecumenical book. It's something that you could share with Protestants. There are distinctively Catholic things in it, and he kind of argues for those things. But there's so much in it that would be shared with a Protestant that I don't think a Protestant would necessarily be off-put by the Catholic elements.
We're speaking about the book To Know Jesus as the Christ, written by Cardinal Schönborn, and he was one of the people who was talked about as a possible candidate for the Pope's job, and obviously we have Pope Francis, but what do you think his role is going to be going forward in the Church, and in terms of publishing, how important it is to keep his works in front of the English-speaking audiences?
Well, I mean, who knows? I think Pope Francis will be around for a while, so I don't know if Cardinal Schönborn will get another opportunity to possibly be the Pope, but those are kind of things, and that's all in God's hands. And people speculate about stuff like that. Who knows? But I think he will continue to be the Archbishop of Vienna for some time. But also, he has a lot of impact in the Vatican, and I know he's good. He's got a good relationship with Pope Francis, and is supportive of the Holy Father's efforts to deepen reform in the Church. And I kind of underscore deepen reform, because really we've seen a kind of movement to reform going back to Paul VI. You know, the pace was picked up with John Paul II and Benedict XVI, but really it's reached a kind of a high point with Francis. And Cardinal Schönborn, who became a bishop under John Paul II and a cardinal under John Paul II, has been a major player in that. You know, looking at things like Catechism of the Catholic Church, which was an effort to reform catechesis coming out of the Council, and a lot of the confusion about what the Church actually teaches and believes today. So he's a major contributor to that kind of reform movement.
Yeah, and also in terms of evangelization, you mentioned it earlier, how he talked about how this book could merely be like a sort of a stepping stone on an ecumenical process. But he certainly, you know, has that in mind. He's certainly reaching out and doing this catechesis in his own diocese. So do you see, in terms of the new evangelization and this new Pentecost that people are talking about, and the importance of people picking up his books and Ignatius Press, you know, making them available?
Yeah, we love Cardinal Schönborn. He's a friend of ours. We publish his books because we think he has something to contribute in this period of time in the history of the Church. And, of course, the new evangelization is an important component. He makes a point that sometimes we make a distinction between evangelization and catechesis, and that's important. Evangelization is the proclamation of the gospel, initiating people into the gospel, or deepening their response to Jesus in faith, so there can be ongoing evangelization. And catechesis is that sort of systematic teaching about Jesus, but it's not, as Cardinal Schönborn points out, it's not just a teaching about, like you might sit and take a course in American history and, gee, if you have a really good teacher, that'd be he'd be challenging, inspiring, and bring you into, you know, the whole world of American history, but it's not necessarily going to be a life-changing experience, whereas catechesis shouldn't just be learning about, kind of stuffing our heads with truths about the faith, as important as those as that is, but it should be about discipleship and a closer following of Jesus and bringing Jesus to other people in ways that are particular to what we believe about Jesus and what we believe he's revealed about us and our destiny and so on. So catechesis is a very important part of the whole process of the new evangelization, and that's what he's trying to address in the book.
Well, we've been speaking with Mark Brumley, and he's talking about the book To Know Jesus as the Christ, written by Cardinal Schönborn. And we thank you so much, Mark, for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me with you.
Thanks for getting up so early, Mark.
God bless you.
All right, bye-bye.